Blog Talk Radio.
It's time for the Exposed Vet, Haddit.com Veteran Podcast. Exposed Vet has teamed up with Haddit.com to bring you in-depth information about all issues affecting today's veteran. Now, here's your host, John and Gerald.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to another episode of the Exposed Vet, Haddit.com Podcast. Today is the 27th day of January, 2022, and we're live on the frozen tundra. Cold out there, folks. The co-host today is Mr. Gerald Cook. How you doing, Gerald?
Doing fine, John. Warm up a bit.
Well, I know. I'm trying to get them to blow some hot air this way, but the people that can do that, I guess they're on vacation, so I don't know what's going to happen. But we got a treat today, folks. We got Dr. Bash and Bill Krieger. And subject matter of today's show is going to be non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. And Dr. Bash is going to start off with it and then give us a breakdown of what it is, and Bill's going to come in and give us some legal stuff on it. So with further ado, how you doing, Dr. Bash?
I'm good, I'm good. I just have a couple of little pearls, you know. So as we do these cases, I'm seeing a lot of places where the patient puts in his intent to file, and then he puts in his 526EZ, you know, within the one-year time period. And he puts his 526 EZ in naked. So Alice has been telling patients, don't put your EZ in naked, because if you do, the VA is just going to deny it right off the bat. So make sure you always get your doctor letter or your DBQs and your Nexus letter, all that stuff put together with your 526 EZ, because the VA will deny it within that 1 year period, even like 30 days, 60 days later.
What I'd recommend on a situation right there is go ahead and do an intent to file. Then get your information, you've gotten and then do it that way. Do the intent part.
Right, get it all together. Right, exactly right. Right. The other thing is, Gerald said something last time about metformin, right? Gerald, you're asking about complications from metformin or side effects or something like that?
Yes.
I think, yeah. So I looked it up. You know, I'm not a treating doctor, and I don't think I've ever treated metformin, but you know, I was reading about it a little bit, and it's an old drug, and they're not really sure exactly how it works. It goes through the liver and messes around the glucose metabolism. So you can get side effects. There's two big side effects that can actually cause death. One is low glucose. You know, it can cause arrhythmias in the heart, death. And the second one is just lactic acidosis. These are all really rare, like 0.1% complications. But so you have to watch out for those two things. The other things that happen, you get some nausea and vomiting. So it's supposedly a pretty safe drug. You know, the safety of it is much safer than the disease. So that's kind of the idea that goes on. But now I'm not sure what Gerald's question was exactly. When I have patients, what I do is I kind of go the other way around. Like I had a guy last week who was drowned. He was drowned. And I go, how'd you drown? He goes, I was like Navy SEAL. I was in the bottom of the pool. You know, so, you know, and they pulled him out and water in his lungs. So how'd that happen? He says, well, I failed the Navy SEAL training before. So I was in the pool as a go around the second time. I wasn't going to fail. So I stayed there as long as I could, you know. I'm going like, well, why couldn't you get up? He said, my leg hurt, had pain in his calves. And so what was that about? He said it had to do with compartment syndrome. So all your muscles, you know, Schwarzenegger cut muscles are contained in these compartments. It's like a banana skin with a banana on the inside. The banana is like the muscle and the skin is like the compartment. So certain things can cause that swelling inside the muscle. It's called compartment syndrome. Blood can't get in. And that's what he had. So I said, he had two sets of compartment syndrome. He couldn't swim. He said, yeah. I said, well, what kind of medications were you on? Nothing. I just took Motrin. I said, Motrin. So what I did, so this is what I do, is I usually find the disease and then work backwards, look for the complications. So I looked around. I looked up Motrin and compartment syndrome. Bingo. There's a relationship between those two things. So this guy almost drowned. He's going to get, you know, he's going to get CNS damage, memory, hypoxia. And his brain is all going to be related to service secondary to secondary to secondary because of the Motrin and compartment syndrome.
So, would that be, you know, would that kind of fit in along with edema where your legs swell and beat?
Yeah. It's the same kind of thing. Like you might get swelling. Like sometimes you overuse the muscle and you get swelling inside the compartment. The banana starts to swell inside the skin. And then the blood can't get in, the nerves can't work, and the whole thing, kind of the muscle starts to fail. In this case, the Motrin, I think the Motrin causes a little bit of microhemorrhages inside the muscle, and then that microhemorrhages takes up a little space, and then that's enough to cause the swelling of the muscle and compartment syndrome. A lot of times people get an infection or they'll get a missile wound in there, bleeding, stuff like that. But this is pretty unusual for, in my mind, for it's an unusual disease, but then for Motrin to cause that, it was kind of a surprise to me. So,
well, a long-term edema then could really create some issues on people.
Because the blood has, 120 over 80 has got to be able to have enough pressure to get into the muscle. And if that compartment has pressure that's higher than that, then the blood can't, overcome that. You can't get good circulation, for starters.
Well, that's true.
Nerves can't get blood. Yeah.
Now, how does compression socks work? Because you're removing the liquid,
Yeah, there's different places where edema can occur. This edema occurs like inside the muscle compartment, right inside that banana skin. But around those muscles, there's this other space, it's like third space, where the lymphatic system takes over, a little bit of fluid in that space. And so sometimes when you have edema, a lot of it fills up in that space outside the muscles, in that fluid, under the skin and around the muscles. That's called third spacing. So when you have that, then the socks or the compression boots or the wraps they have can help squeeze that muscle out for people who have like lymphedema or maybe cardiac problems or renal third space fluid. So several places the fluid can build up, like inside the cell, around the cell, inside the muscle, around the muscles, under the skin. There's like all these different places that fluid can gather, so it depends on the process.
That's very interesting.
All right. Yeah. So that's a side effect. So I'm not sure the metformin, if somebody has some weird side effect, I could look it up the other way around and see if I could link it to service to help them out that way, Because you go crazy looking down those lists of side effects because patients don't know what they mean, and you start thinking you have every disease on the side effect list, So, all right, so I'm going to shift gears now a little bit to non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. There's like 60 different types, and this gets down to those books, those Vietnam Veterans and Agent Orange books, and there's all kinds of different diagnoses in there. And a lot of those talk about lymphoma and non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. And as it turns out, most of those diseases, all those cancers, are due in some way or another, a lot of them, to Agent Orange. If you look at the research articles behind those books, every 2 years they have a bunch of them out for a couple decades. You'll find research that shows that. So that's what Bill's going to talk about, is some of the linkages with the rating schedule with the people's exposures. But for patients, they normally, talk about fever or belly pain, chest pain, but a lot of times patients will have nodes, like they have nodes in their neck or under their skin, under their axilla. And so as an imager, as a radiologist, we get involved in that a lot because we do CT scans, MRI scans. We find these nodes and we look at them for size. And then as a radiologist, we look at them for treatment. So you can't really tell what this node's about until you biopsy. So a lot of these patients have biopsies of lymph nodes, and they find these different types of Hodgkin's lymphoma. And, the medicine is doubling like every 2 months, so the treatments for these things can be, variable depending on what part of the country you go to and what center. But basically, it has a lot to do with X-ray treatment or chemotherapy and stem cell. So these kind of fall in, these are lymphatic-driven tumors, and they kind of fall in this blood cell line tumors. Now, my dad had a blood cell line tumor called myasthenia gravis. And he was treated at Hopkins. And back, 10, 15 years ago, Hopkins was treating patients, and they found out if they treated them for other types of cancers, like if they had maybe renal cell cancer, and they ablated their immune system, gave them radiation and knocked their whole immune system down, and then the immune system, they rebooted it basically, either with stem cells or left a few cells, and it rebooted the immune system. The immune system would grow back up from the little baby immune system, and the immune system would forget about the myasthenia gravis. And so some of these other kinds of blood cell cancers the same way. Sometimes when you reboot the immune system, take it down to zero, and bring it back up, the immune system will kind of reset itself with its DNA and it will forget some of these cancers. So that's sometimes the way they treat this. And then if they do that, then we follow it, images, we follow a lot and look for the size of lymph nodes and see if the nodes are getting smaller over time, remain static. There might even be a lifelong survey to check and see what the status of that is. Now, we always think about secondaries, and this is what you always have to have your doctor ask about, is the secondaries, like that patient has talked about, secondaries from Motrin to the compartment syndrome to the anoxia, hypoxia. And the same thing here, the treatment, like the radiation treatment and the chemo treatment, oftentimes patients have a lot of different problems, like with neuropathy, nerve damage in their extremities or in the radiation port. Like you see patients with Hodgkin's mantle radiation, they can have, you know, loss of bone marrow in their two bodies, and, you know, large swaths of the body has been affected by the radiation changes. So that would be something the patients could look for, would be the secondary complications. So Bill's going to tell us about some of the rating things, right, Bill? Some of the rules and laws about this stuff?
Sure. Are we ready?
yep.
All right. Non-Hodgkin's lymphoma can be rated as a service-connected disability. Now, we're all familiar. We've talked about direct service connection, okay? So if a veteran comes down with non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, assuming it's well after service, and there is a medical link between something that happened in service or something that was present in service and the current diagnosis, we call that the nexus, if the medical evidence, typically an opinion, provides the link between service and the diagnosis, then you get direct service connection. Most often that would be under 38 CFR 3.303D, post-service initial diagnosis of illness. Now that is available, it always has been, for practically any disease, if you can find that nexus. But there is also an opportunity to have service connection granted without medical nexus evidence. And there are a couple of ways to do that. One, the law provides that this can be presumed to be a result of exposure to the contaminated water at Camp Lejeune. It also could be presumably related to exposure to herbicides under the same presumptive considerations accorded the other disease for herbicides.
Hey, Bill.
Yeah?
Hey, Bill, that water thing doesn't extend to other bases, right, just specifically for Lejeune?
No, just Lejeune.
Yeah.
I most of my life I called it Camp Lejeune because it kind of looks like that. And most Marines do. most of us do. But then I heard an interview with his widow, and she pronounced it Lejeune. So I'm with that. They actually had a campaign down there in North Carolina. They had license plates that said, say Lejeune. They're trying to teach everybody. That was able to pronounce. But anyhow, just Camp Lejeune. Not been accepted as presumptive for other bases or exposures. Now, there's been an interesting change with Public Law 116.315. That was signed by President Trump on January 5th of 2021. And that has changed the presumptive period for herbicide exposure. And now, you know, this has been revised several times, okay? So, you know, early on, there was a requirement for in-country service from August of 64, that would be the landing at Da Nang, to May 7th of 75, the end of the Vietnam era. Then it was modified, and it was, it included service in country all the way back to February 28th, 1961, okay? But now, with this new law, service in country beginning November 1st, 1955 applies. Ooh. So those troops that were in country all the way back in 1955 are now covered under this. And expressly, it includes that offshore waters that was previously expanded to include the waters adjacent to. You remember that was enacted a few years back. And that that means anybody whose ship went in to the coastal waters of Vietnam would then be covered. Now, coastal waters in Vietnam in 1955 gets you the presumption. There might be some out there, and I'm really concerned because those guys probably are up in age if they were there at that time. They're probably up in age now. And if they are suffering with non-Hodgkin's lymphoma and not able to know about these new changes, I would hope that this will get the word out to them, to their relatives, or to their service officers out there in their posts or chapters, and that we could reach out to them and get them service connected. That's certainly one thing I really hope comes from this. Now, if we achieve service connection, okay, how do we evaluate non-Hodgkin's lymphoma? Well, like most cancers, if it's an active disease, it's 100% for as long as it's active. Secondly, if it's being treated, so long as it's in the treatment phase, it's 100%. And then, once treatment ends, it continues for 100% for 2 years. 2 years. Now, then you should get a review exam, and then it'll be determined whether or not there should be some permanency.
Hey, Bill, now, it's a pretty long period, 2 years, right? Most cancers, they don't extend that long, do they?
No, most are a year. But with non-Hodgkin's lymphoma and what VA calls other persistent cancers, okay, that's the magic word here, persistent cancers. The rating schedule now provides a 2-year continuation at 100%. However, okay, not in all cases. In fact, M21 in its current version was changed in June of 2019. And it makes clear that, not just chemotherapy or the like, or radiation that you mentioned before, but bone marrow transplants and stem cell. Okay, if you get either of those, that provides for 100% evaluation for treatment and 2 years thereafter. Now, the big change, and I had a debate with this when I was still rating for VA. The big change is that VA has determined that if non-Hodgkin lymphoma after treatment becomes what's called indolent and non-contiguous. Okay, so if it goes into an indolent and non-contiguous phase of low-grade non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, you continue the 100% and you consider permanency. Now the manual say again?
Some of these patients back to imaging could have a large residual mass of lymph node tissue. And that might be the category that you're talking about,
Yes, or it might be just low grade, but still present. And
right.
See, one of the problems with non-Hodgkin's lymphoma is that the recurring treatment periods oftentimes extend more than the period between the treatments extends more than a year.
Right.
And maybe for some patients more than 2 years. And
yeah,
so
right.
VA decided that it will be at the end of the treatment phase, it will be 100% for 2 years. But they're making clear in the manual. Now listen to this very, very important phrase from M21. Now, you find these, you know, M21 has been completely renumbered, okay, all kinds of different sections now. So for those that are making notes of such things, M21-1, part 5, 392B. That's the paragraph. That's M21-1, 5392B. Now that's important because here's what it says. When evaluating the need for a review exam at the 2-year period prescribed in the rating schedule for discontinuance of the treatment phase for non-Hodgkin's lymphoma or any other persistent cancer with a high mortality rate, consider that the various therapeutic treatment modalities may continue at intervals greater than the review period indicated in the rating schedule. Okay, like I just said, now they're telling the rater, consider that, you know, the interval between the treatment periods might be greater than the review period of 2 years. So here's the next paragraph. If the disease has actively persisted for several years, thoroughly examine the medical record to determine whether the disease is actually in remission or still active and being regularly treated over extended periods of time.
Now, so do I go back to my image again? You know, if the CT or MR shows the large masses of abnormally large lymphatics, that would be, in my opinion, the evidence that it's, you know, persistent.
Yeah, and that's that persistency that they're trying to alert the raters to be alert to. Now, indolent, in medical parlance, that means slow to develop, progress, or heal. Persistent, okay? So many NLH and NHL patients are not going to be cured. They're going to have the symptoms controlled and diminished, but it doesn't mean the disease isn't still there. And that's the patients that VA's manual is now concerned about. And it tells the rater, do not schedule a review examination unless the record clearly shows a long-term and stable remission.
Okay, Bill, I was just reading something about non-Hodgkin's. It says indolent lymphoma can last for 20 years or more.
Right. So that is important. And when you get a VA exam or if you're getting a private DBQ for non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, the DBQ is going to prompt the examiner to select one of those three. There are three boxes to pick from and only three. Okay? The form is going to ask, is it active? That's one box. The form is going to ask, is it in the treatment phase? That's one box. And then the third is it indolent and non-continuous phase of low-grade non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. That's the third box. So here's what I'm saying. Those three boxes are the three criteria listed in the rating schedule for the 100% evaluation, and the doctor is going to have to pick one of them. No matter which one of those three the doctor picks, it's 100%. See? So we should expect that most of our cases for our veterans, they should be deemed permanent and not have to undergo a review exam. Now that, you know, there are certain ancillary benefits that come along with that permanency determination. So that's an important finding. But, you know, there's going to be some variations case to case, but that's important to know about. Now, I want to talk about pension, okay, non-service-connected pension. We sometimes don't think about that because, you know, most folks have a Social Security that exceeds what VA pension allows, you know, and or many do. So right now, the pension ceiling, now if you're a totally and permanently disabled wartime veteran, okay, the pension ceiling is $14,753 a year. And of course, it's higher if you're rendered housebound, and it's higher than that if you require aid and attendance. And wartime service for the Vietnam era, because of that change, is now defined as November 1st, 1955. Okay, so what was previously considered peacetime is now deemed wartime for veterans who served in Vietnam. And they will be eligible to apply for, satisfy the military service requirements for pension. Now, the other point I want to make sure everybody understands, that even if your net worth, I mean your income, is greater than the pension ceiling, you are allowed to deduct certain expenses like medical expenses. And so if the medical expenses would equal or approximate your income, then your net income for VA purposes would be zero, and you would get the full pension. Now, that used to happen years back for vets in nursing homes because, you know, living on Social Security, maybe a little pension of some sort, that doesn't come anywhere near the medical costs of living in a nursing home. And so we could get pension for those veterans. So that's important. Now, those are the highlights I wanted to make sure that we got out there in the air.
Hey, Dick, can you go back over that, those check boxes, permanent versus non-permanent, one more time?
Sure. Okay. On the DBQ, I'll call it up, the examiner is prompted. When you come down to non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, okay, there's a check block. The doctor checks the diagnosis, non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. Then beneath that, on the next line, it prompts the doctor to check one of three boxes. The first one is active disease. That's 100%. The second one is treatment phase. That's 100%. The third one is indolent and non-contiguous phase of low-grade non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. And that's 100%. So what does it tell you? If the doctor fills out the form and checks one of the boxes, you're going to get 100%.
Yeah.
You know, don't need to find much else. You know? Okay.
Very interesting stuff there, Bill.
Bill, what if he doesn't mark any boxes?
They'll probably send it back for clarification.
He's not doing his job.
Yeah. Now, there's one more sentence, and remember we were in M21 here talking about future exams, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And it says, important, consider assigning a P&T evaluation, permanent and total, when a provision of 38 CFR 3.327B2 applies or is otherwise warranted. Now, 3.327 describes when the rater should or should not order a review exam. And it says, no future exam shall be ordered. Okay? One of those is age 55. So if the manual is saying consider 327, and if you're over age 55, 327 says don't schedule a future exam, rated as permanent.
This applies only to the non-Hodgkin's category?
Yes, this is in the non-Hodgkin's.
Okay.
That's right. That section of M21 that says how you evaluate non-Hodgkin's lymphoma says consider 327. And 327 says,
such a problem.
Right.
Okay.
Age 55 or 5 years, 5 years, no future.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah.
Establishes static, no material improvement for 5 years or more. It's permanent in character or no likelihood of improvement.
Mm-hmm.
Veteran over age 55.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so those.
That's a very important point, Bill. 55 age. I mean, it's. I guess they consider that advanced age. So,
well, for that, for review exam purposes, yes, and that regulation has been there as long as I have. I mean,
right.
So
actually,
calls that.
Actually, that
advanced.
That provision has been in effect since 1961. Okay? So if you're over age 55 and you have a service-connected disability and you should not be subject to review examinations, it should be deemed permanent. So like a veteran, let's say you have... I don't know. Let's say you're PTSD, okay? If I'm now granting you service connection for PTSD and you're 60 years old, whatever evaluation I assign, 50%, 100%, I do not schedule a future exam because you're over 55.
What's a caveat there, Bill, that kind of reverses that? I mean, you say, example, a guy's got 50% PTSD. He's over 55. He files for an increase on PTSD at age 55. Mm-hmm. That allows the VA to open up the record and take a look, and they could reduce a veteran.
That's correct. And I've seen it, for not just PTSD, but for others. And I have, in innumerable cases, when I was a representative, an advocate, I was able to persuade the Board of Veterans Appeals, years after the fact, to reverse that reduction and restore it because they didn't touch all the bases that apply to reductions. I think one of the most frequent mistakes that I've seen is raters who treat a reduction as if it were a claim for increase. If it's a claim for increase, or a routine reevaluation, okay, then it's whatever the evidence shows. But if you want to reduce the evaluation, there's a whole shopping list of requirements. You know, it has to be material improvement, not just improvement, but material improvement. Not just material improvement, but sustained material improvement under the ordinary circumstances of daily life, including employment. Okay, so you have to consider how it's affected his employment. And if a vet hasn't been employed for a while, you don't have proof that it's no longer affecting employment because he's not employed, okay? So you don't make the reduction. And, of course, you have to give the 60-day notice before you schedule the reduction. And so there are others, but we won't hang up on all of them here, but there are others. And frequently, raters effectuate a reduction, and the only thing they're thinking about is, well, okay, today's exam, the symptoms look like 30% to me, so I'm taking them from 50 to 30. Wrong. And if you don't consider all those other factors, then you're not permitted to reduce. And I've succeeded in reversing a lot of those over time because they treat it as a level playing field when it isn't. It's skewed to the veteran's favor deliberately, consciously, and lawfully. Okay? And so that's something to watch for in reductions. They're just times. And I wish they'd stop doing that, but I can't. I must say that I've seen some more cases in recent years that
we've done a lot of those, Bill.
Yes, we have. We've succeeded in some of those to sooner or later get to the right pair of ears who can hear, right pair of eyes that can see and read and say, oh, yeah, that is the law. Okay. It's restored.
You said that so confidently, Bill.
Well, all I can say is that when they hit my desk when I was making these decisions, I restored them, you know? And when I was an advocate and when I was, practicing in the court and practicing at BVA, I would say the most errors that I was able to reverse were severance. The last doctor said yes, but this one says no, so here you're getting severed. No, that's not the law. I've been able to overturn a lot of those or persuade VA to reverse them. The other one is in reductions, where they do not apply the rules of reduction. They are only applying the rules for evaluation. And that mistake was common enough to allow me to get a number of those reversed by BVA or the court. The court, forgive me for not remembering the citation right now, but typically what the court would do in that circumstance is to say, you don't get another bite of the apple, VA. You know, we're not sending this back for another debate. It was void ab initio from the beginning, and you're going to restore it. So that's important. And then I guess the third most common error that I would find was the evaluation of wounds and muscles, because there is substantially more involved than raters think about. You know, when there's a whole series of paragraphs in part four when it comes to rating, as a preamble to rating muscles, that give you specific findings and symptoms, and if they're present, that's evidence of the higher evaluation, even if it's not totally consistent with the current manifestations. Like, let's say you got a through and through wound of a major muscle group. It's 20% in many cases. Okay, so you've recovered and you're doing okay now, and the examiner finds you have full strength. And I've seen rating decisions that say, okay, it's 0%. No, it isn't. It's 20% because the regulation says a three and through wound is 20%. Hello. So I got a number of those fixed too. Anyhow, a little off track here on the non-Hodgkin's lymphoma stuff.
That's all right.
But, you know, it's important to know now that we have people eligible for pension who were previously peacetime veterans from 55 to 64. And now the Vietnam era is defined by the new law as wartime for pension purposes from November of 55. Yeah, you got time for a little bit of a story here. I'd like to tell it. When I was hired as a veteran service officer for the state of Maryland on Maryland's lower eastern shore, one of the things my predecessor told me about was he had always been saddened by the fact that he could not get to nursing homes to see to it all those veterans in nursing homes were getting the things they're entitled to. And I made a point. I recruited some work-study students on VA work-study program. And I also recruited some of my students. I was on the adjunct faculty of Salisbury and in the social work program. And I had about, per semester, I had about two students who would do some internship in my office to help with veterans issues. And I used those resources to give me an opportunity to get out of the office. So I had coverage in the office, and I could get out to those nursing homes. And the team I assembled, we reached out to what was left of those World War I veterans really, really quickly, and we were able to get a lot of benefits to them that they had no idea about.
So, Bill, I'm starting to reach out to homeless veterans, you know, and those guys that were in nursing homes are now living in Walmarts in their pickup trucks, you know.
Yeah.
I had a guy this week that, homeless veteran, no computer, you know, no smartphone, and we wanted to do his forms for him. He says, why? I can't do my forms until I only have an eighth of a tank of gasoline in my truck, and I can't do my forms at the library until the first part of the month, you know? So it's the same kind of problem. Now it's not nursing home, but it's the guys in the Walmarts and homeless shelters and stuff. They can't get stuff.
Yeah. Wow.
And they all deserve benefits. They're all sitting there like with 30, 40%, 50%. They're way underrated, you know, oftentimes. They don't know what to know about.
Found so much of it.
Just like you're talking about, right? Same story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Era.
Yeah. And I had a fellow working for me, who was working on his master's degree in military history. And he was focusing on World War I. So at the same time, he would conduct interviews with these old boys and go over things. And he would discover that most of them never received their ribbons and medals that they were entitled to. So we made a point of getting them and then having them come to VFW for a free dinner, and we would award them their medals. And that was so emotional. Oh, those were great events. They were just great.
Recognition, right.
Yeah.
Decades later, right, Bill? 20, 40, 50 years?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. A lot of them said, yeah, you're the first one that ever asked.
I got another story for you. This gets back to doctors asking questions about the cases. So this lady has a disc rupture, and she goes to the hospital, East Coast, and they go, how'd you hurt your neck? Because I was washing my hair. So they did a CT scan and kind of poo-pooed her because it didn't sound like much of an accident, and she had kind of plus-minus symptoms. And the CT scan's like normal except for straightening of the spine, which oftentimes might be muscle spasm, but they just let her go. She goes home a couple days later, and she has paralysis. Her legs can't climb stairs, arms weak, comes back and gets an MRI scan, and she has a ruptured disc. Cord compression, the whole works.
Wow.
So they still understand, like, what's going on? How this happened? So I get referred to me, and I start asking her the stupid questions I ask sometimes, where were you washing your hair? I was washing my hair in the sink. Like, why were you washing your hair in the sink? Well, she's like from Ethiopia, has that long, black, rope-like hair. She says, I just can't wash it in the shower. I got to wash it in the sink and use the nozzle and all that stuff. It works really nice. So, like, how did you hurt your neck? Well, once I washed, she's like 35 now or so. She does it all the time, but she's getting older. I take my hair and I sling it. I sling it left and right to dry it off. And so, it's like the fighter pilot G-forces, right? All that weight in the hair gave her a whiplash, basically. And she
whiplash.
All right, all right. That's just the value of the doctor. I just get back at the value of the doctor asking questions and try and snoop out some of this forensics. Bill and I do that a lot. But, it just has a value for secondary complications and the real root cause of the problem, like the drowning guy and stuff. Those stories come in, and they're gratifying because it helps the patients. Once you get the diagnosis right and the cause, it's sometimes the case, and it becomes more simple.
So the bottom line is, ladies, if you listen to the show and you have long hair, please do not do that.
Don't swing it around.
Since we have a few minutes left, I go back to this public law 116.315. That also contains a provision, and I haven't seen anything in the media about it, but Section 1164 of this presumes service connection for the coronavirus, okay, including reservists or National Guard who are called up. So if you're called up to serve during, your guard service, we recall a number who were called up to provide healthcare and to do logistics. And if you served 48 hours and developed the disease within 2 weeks or 14 days, it's presumed to be service connected. Thought it might be kind of.
Oh. And it's like, this sucker's going to have more residuals than unknown.
So don't poo-poo those residuals. They just had an article about mild COVID, and 9 months later, people couldn't put pins in the squares and things like that. A big chunk of them had memory problems and hand function. There's another patient.
That's right. They're finding all sorts of issues.
Every body, organ, brain, heart, everything gets affected. Muscles. So there's another patient in Baltimore who had symptoms. Who was like. They tested him 3 times negative for COVID, and then he died from a cardiac event. Like, they weren't sure it was a heart attack. And so somehow NIH heard about that, and they wanted to find out why this 35-year-old guy died. They brought NIH to the autopsy. They tested 300 body fluids and tissues. All of those body fluids and tissues were negative for COVID, except for the appendix. The appendix had one area that had positive COVID testing, and it turns out that the DNA fingerprint of that section of the appendix was the same DNA fingerprint of the heart, and so the heart was killed by a usual suspect bystander from the COVID. So like Gerald said, there's going to be all kinds of weird things that come out of this thing for decades later about secondary complications and other organ systems we never even thought about before.
And we thought the VA would slow down some, but they're going to keep getting more and more and more. This is a big one. I mean, everybody in their brain has got it, going to have it.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah. Add to that, this bill has unbelievable page after page of reporting requirements. VA has to report this. VA has to assemble and report this. Has to assemble and report that. So there's a lot of work for people to go to work to VA and generate reports.
So what was that? What was that? 48 hours? It's 48 hours in the war zone next to COVID patient, or what was it? How was that defined?
No. It's just that if you're called up for the emergency, okay, or you know, you don't even have to have. They're not even including the definition of active duty. You know, if regardless of that, if you're called up by the president and you serve for 48 straight hours and then get out and within 14 days are diagnosed with COVID, it's presumed service connected.
Wow.
Yeah. And then there are a lot of pages about our Native American tribes, a lot of benefits and stuff, and improving health care for women veterans and education and, my golly, and expanding opportunities for community care. And, of course, they've made this community care stuff effective 2023 for some reason, but, you know.
Figures.
Yeah.
We can vouch for the American Indians and people like that. I mean, if there's some folks that we know that it's pretty sad in those areas.
Oh, yes.
You know, Stacey, I worked on a reservation for a couple of years in Arizona back in the day, Apache land, you know. So we had pretty good outreach. I mean, they're very poor, and they, you know, a lot of them are patriots working in the government and the military. But we had the way we did it was we had the public health service, had a hospital there, kind of like a VA outpatient clinic, basically. And we had a bunch of doctors there from Phoenix and Tucson. So we were doing a pretty good job with what we had, the resources, but, you know, the distances are so far, and it's hard to get specialists. Like, I was a radiologist. They wanted me to travel all around the other places, and they couldn't do it. So our hospital had more expertise. But you're right. There's a lot of room for improvement out there.
Let me guess. Yeah. Your highest disabilities in that area were what, diabetes and hypertension?
Well, you know, as it turns out, the tribes have different types of diseases. You know, of course, diabetes and hypertension were a problem, but the Pimas, but a lot of different tribes have, like, genetic basis for kidney disease, stuff like that. So you got to look at the tribe and see what their underlying disease profile is, because each one is different genetic makeup, the diet.
Yeah. Well, I think the main Cherokee is hypertension and diabetes, so I don't know about the other tribe. But,
there's a lot of that.
Yeah.
Okay. Alcohol, bottles of the face, all kinds of stuff like that.
Yeah, alcohol is a big one.
Yeah. Ice and Gun Club, you know, goes on and on.
Yeah. Funny.
Folks, we learn a whole lot. Go ahead, Bill.
Funny incident. I referred to as American Indians, and a younger person immediately wanted to jump and correct me and say Native Americans. And I said, well, I asked the chief of the tribal council what he preferred, and he said American Indian. But that's not what they want to be called. They want to be called Cherokee, Navajo, Blackfoot. That's what they want to be called.
Right. So one of the priest guys goes down, and they have all these warriors, and the Apaches are hated by the Navajo and vice versa, you know, for centuries. And so they're still trying to make peace between those tribes, you know. They go and they try and ask for forgiveness, and, you know, making some inroads with that stuff, but they're all very proud of their history and their place in the earth, and, you know, and they have the medicine men carry those memories, and so a lot of that stuff gets passed down, and it's, in the history, it's hard to overcome a lot of times, you know.
Yeah, it kind of reminds you of those Scottish Highland clans, doesn't it?
Yeah. Different, they have different hospitals, like Hopi has a hospital, Navajo Hospital, Apache. They all had their own little hospitals, even though they're 10 feet apart, stuff like that.
That's interesting stuff.
I remember back in the day when they had all them TB hospitals across the country after the war.
Oh, yeah.
There was a lot of them.
Yeah.
Eastern Shore experienced that. I recall, we were talking about those World War I vets, and some of them, when they came back, they had been gassed. So they're home, they start to cough up some blood, and they immediately get diagnosed with TB. They put them in a TB ward.
Double whammy, right, Bill?
Mustard gas lung. That's a bad situation. A lot of people were affected by that stuff back in the day.
Yeah.
And then they had to put up with the Spanish flu afterward. Boy, I tell you what, the hits just kept coming back then, didn't it?
Yep, yep. And there weren't quite the resources available that we have today.
Well, that's a good thing, too. You were discussing the 55 age and some of the older veterans when it's non-Hodgkin stuff, too. You know, back in the day, especially somebody that age, you know, computers wasn't really available back then. You know, and information was hard to get out. You know, but what the information they received is what they were told or what they read. So, I mean, there's probably a lot of vets out there that have no idea that this is actually, you know, a benefit to them.
Yeah. And, you know, some of this stuff, you know, it's going to be a while before, been over a year. And some of this stuff is not showing up in the manual. Some of it is. Some of it's not showing up in the manual. Some of it's not showing up in the regulations. But I spoke with the folks at Martinsburg, West Virginia Hospital, and they're aware of it, and they're saying we're planning on having funds available and doing some expanding in home care and community care beginning in 2023.
Well, I guess you're going to get the show this weekend, aren't you, Bill?
Not here. I live next to a lake, just below the West Virginia Panhandle.
Yeah.
And we call it the umbrella because generally the weather comes from the west or the southwest. And when it reaches us, it either goes north of us or south of us. It just hardly ever. And we got some snow on the ground still from that last dump. But, when they're saying 50% chance, 2 inches or something like that, no, it ain't.
All right. Hey, guys, we got a minute left. Dr. Bash, give extra contact information if you can so these folks, anybody wants to utilize your services, they need to call and contact. Just give them the information.
Yeah, that's Craig Bash. Call Skip, might be on the line, but it's 925-381-7561. It's Skip again, 925-381-7561. He's my scheduler. Just call him up and you get a half hour with me on the phone, boom, 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 talk about the issues.
Got them folks, give Skip a call, and he'll call you back, set you up, and Dr. Bash will call you, and sometimes they call you early in the morning, so be ready for that.
My calls are always early in the morning. I've got my own spine injury. I don't sleep very well, so I'm always up early in the morning talking.
Well, guys, we appreciate you coming on. We, you guys have been doing this for quite a while, and we'll do it again. Hopefully we can get on and do some other constructive shows and, cover some issues that's affecting today's veteran. There's a lot of issues, and, you got a lot of veterans need a lot of help. So your information that you guys put out is very educational, and it's a good thing. Very good thing.
It's been a really great show. Really informational.
Yes, it is. Learned a lot today. I learned something every time you guys come on, Joe.
Great. Thank you.
Well, all right, guys. Well, that's it. We do appreciate you coming on. And this is John. I have Gerald Cook, Dr. Bash, and Bill Krieger. Tune in next week, another episode of the show. And we'll see you next week.
You've been listening to the Exposed Vet Podcast. All opinions expressed on the show are the opinions of the guest speakers and not necessarily the opinions of Exposed Vet, Haddit.com, or Blog Talk Radio. To leave a comment, send an email to exposedvet@gmail.com. Just put podcast in the subject matter. Tune in next week for another edition of the Exposed Vet Podcast. Thanks for listening.